Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today we have New York Times bestselling author R.A. Salvatore. He's the writer of The Legend of Drizzt, Demon Wars. He wrote Star Wars Vector Prime and his newest book, The Finest Edge of Twilight. We're going to chat about all that and more today on Wandering DMs. Yeah, good catch.
Before we get started, everyone, I'll just remind you, as always, that at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host, where all of you get to talk live to us on our private Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get that all set up before the end of the show, and around 10 minutes after, we'll see you for our live after.
I see
so
in
Mr.
that thing.
Salvatore, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Absolutely. Clowns. Did I see you at Joe Manganiello on?
We did. That was yes. So many seasons ago, but we'd love to include.
I was watching Nanas. Have you seen the movie Nanas?
I haven't.
Joe's in it. And Vince Vaughn and Linda Cardellini's in it. And, you know, Linda Cardellini is like the best out of it. Anyway, I watched the thing, so I texted Joe. I go, "Hey, I'm watching Nanas. You hugged Lindsay Weir, and now I have to hate you." Got a big kick out of that. Freaks and Geeks, my favorite show.
That is a fantastic show.
We love that.
Oh, breaks my heart they didn't get more than a season.
Oh yeah, it was a great show. That was my high school.
Oh, it was same.
Oh goodness! So let's talk about the new book before we get off track on all the stuff that the three of us love. So the finest.
I talk about that too much. I'm doing too many interviews. Let's talk about other stuff.
Okay. Well, okay. Well, whatever then. I'm trying to set it up here.
Maybe, okay. What do you want to know about the new book?
Briefly tell us what's on your mind these days about writing. Yeah.
The best thing about doing this book was that I didn't have a contract. I had turned down sticking with Hopper. I miss my editor David over there. It's just the best. But there were too many conflicting things going on with, you know, if something came out with Drizzt, it was affecting Del Rey because they had the early books, but it wasn't helping sell the new books. And it just was like, I didn't have a contract. There was a bunch of legal stuff I had to go through to get the licensing extended, to do this, to do that. There was a lot of arguing between lawyers with publisher and Watsy, well, Hasbro. And I just, you know what, I said, I'm not even going to worry about that, and just didn't even think about it. I'm collecting Social Security starting next month. I'm already on Medicare. I've got 8 grandkids, and they all live around me. I'm busy. I have fun. And I was like, you know what? I'll write when I want to write. And that's what I did. This book came to me, and I said, because I had been working on the webtoon. They're going to do a breezy webtoon, apparently. And I need a haircut. Bad. They're going to do a breezy webtoon. And I was working on it with Purpa, who's the writer, and with Paul from Wizards of the Coast, and Paul Morrissey. We've been working on that for like a year. And as we were doing that, the character started coming to life for me. As I was relaying to Purpa things I think she should refer to and things she should think about when she's writing a comic. And I just fell in love with the character because there were so many things I saw in the character that I wanted to explore. That's why I write, right? I mean, I write about the Highwayman because I know a guy who was born with cerebral palsy and he was walking around downtown Lemesur, and I always wondered, what must it be like to live your life through his eyes? What's it like? You know, I wrote about Drizzt because I want to know what's it like to be judged on sight and not on anything you've done or said, right? That's why I do things. That's why I write. And for Breezy, I was thinking, what's it going to be like for her? Her parents are the heroes. Her father's a king, wealthy beyond belief. Her mother's a wizard and a priestess, chosen of Maileiki. Her father's like one of the most renowned swordsmen in the world. Her uncle Wulfgar is like this giant former chieftain of a barbarian tribe who can, you know, crush rocks with his teeth. And she's got Regis, who's skilled in other ways, and she's got Uncle Jarl Axel, and Entreri's there, and all. She's got every resource a person could have. On top of that, she's at the Monastery of the Yellow Rose being trained in the ways of the monk. So, and she's got famous parents. And what's that like for kids? What's that like? I just watched the Charlie Sheen documentary that came out, right? It's really good, by the way. It's really good. And it explains a lot. It explains a lot. So what's it like to be someone who's, even if you're talented, to have to jump through hoops, you know, to prove yourself? And even then, no matter what you do, there are going to be people who insist that it's nepotism.
Yep.
And undeniably, there are doors that open, right? Undeniably, there are doors that open to an actor's kid, to a writer's kid in genre. There are doors that open. But what does that do to the kids? Are they not supposed to step through the doors as they grow up and they find that they're love? That's breezy. So I got to explore that.
Is there some of your own kids in this? Do you try to evoke some of their experience? No.
I invoke the things they went through, but not the things they went through. In other words, I analogize the things they went, some of them. Like, you know, what happens if you go to school and you find out that the kid who's pretending to like you wants to meet your dad?
Yeah.
That's kind of, bull, right? What happens if you happen to be this incredibly talented video game designer and people think you're only there because you're dad?
Yep.
You know, I really like the work of the writer Jonah Hill, who does horror stuff, horror comics. And I salute him for using a different name than his father, Stephen King. I can see why he did that, and it makes sense to me. And I can see why, if you literally use the same name, that would actually be throw up more obstacles than you need on your path.
Except if you're the son of Stephen King, do you think that there were doors that you might have known were there, even if they weren't doors that were open for you? If you're the son of famous actor parents, you know, if you're George Clooney's kid, right? What are you going to look like? You won the genetic lottery, right?
Yep.
So, you know, what you go through with these, I mean, what are they going to do? They grow up on set. You know, children of actors grow up in that atmosphere. They understand it. People who move to LA to become actors have no freaking clue. And when they go on set, even for the audition or in front of them, they're going to be way more nervous than people who grew up in that environment. There's a reason why, if you go back in history, so many people's names were Tom Builder or Cobbler or what. And that's not because it's not predestiny. It's because those doors open, right? So here I've got Breezy. Everything's expected of her. She thinks that she's beyond that, and there's some harsh lessons that she's got to learn. And the only one who treats her as if her parents don't matter is Jarl Axel. And he's doing that for her own good. So I had an absolute blast writing this book. And like I said, I wrote it with no contract. I just wanted to do it, so I did it. And then I sold it.
And
I think it's right up there with anything I've ever written.
That's fantastic. Is it the start of a series? I was trying to get a signal on that. Do you intend to have more books in the same series about her?
I have two books under contract right now. One is the last book in Demon Wars. I'm finally done with Demon Wars, and it's breaking my heart that I'm done, but I know it's time. And the other one I can't really talk about right now. I have nothing else under contract. I have no idea what I'm doing after this. I don't know. if I get the urge to write another book, maybe I'll write another book.
Now, you did have, a Polygon interview recently where you suggested you might just flat out retire from writing books.
They blew that out of proportion. It was a great interview, but they focused on that one thing. That's the headline, right? I said I was retiring because I start collecting Social Security in November. 66 and 10 months, I can start collecting Social Security, and any income outside doesn't look like my Social Security check. And I'm on Medicare because I'm over 65. And I'm not going under contract. I don't want to be on deadlines anymore. That's like the number one thing for me. Like, I'm not going to go sign a 5-book deal unless that 5-book deal or 3-book deal or 2-book deal changes my life. And I don't see anything changing my life at this point because I've got everything I want and I don't want much. You know? Oh, if I take this book deal, I can buy a Lamborghini. I don't want a Lamborghini. I can't even get in and out of a Lamborghini anymore. I'm too old. My knees are bad. That's the thing. I don't care about things, and everything I have is right here. So that's not the impetus to go and get under pressure again. So I don't see me signing another book deal. Doesn't mean I won't write another book. And if I write a book, I'll publish it if somebody wants it, and I think they will. But, so retiring is kind of a little too harsh, I think, but I've definitely slowed down. I've got other priorities in my life right now, and one of them is knowing that you know, you're not immortal here. The things you want to do, you better do. And I don't need to be sitting at home typing when I've got 7 grandkids playing around them or 8 grandkids playing around in my pool. I want to be in there cannonballing them. It's really that simple.
That was my takeaway from that Polygon article. I noticed you talked about bringing the grandkids to the D&D table. I'm curious, you have like 3 generations of Salvatores now throwing D20s down?
No. They're too, well, yeah, there is actually, because my oldest grandson's 15, Brian's oldest, and he plays in our D&D group. Awesome. He DMs too. He's really good. He makes up his own monsters, and we have no idea what we're fighting. It's usually really bad. He's like, he's dark. He's DMing. He's dark. I love it. He's really great. So we do have 3 generations, but the game Gino ran was for the younger kids because there's Julian, and then we go down to age 9, 9, 8, 6, 5, and then 2 little ones who aren't ready yet. But even the 5-year-old played. Of course, all he wanted to do was fight the other. I want to hit Milo's guy because he wanted action. But it worked out pretty well. Gino ran a straightforward and fun game for them. I helped them roll dice. You roll this one.
Nine sounds like the right age to me. I remember cracking open the basic D&D box set and seeing on the cover that it said for ages 10 and up and being like, uh-oh, I'm going to get in trouble. You're like, 9, well, probably the right age.
Yeah, when we play, Brian brings his 9-year-old, Gino brings his 9-year-old, and Katie's 8-year-old is here when we play. The 3 of them come too. And we don't use whiteboards anymore. So I've got all these whiteboards and markers and stuff. But we don't use those anymore because we use the TV with VTT. But we actually use minis on the TV. We actually use the miniatures, our Hero Forge miniatures and monsters and stuff on the TV. But we don't map on the whiteboard anymore. We use a VTT. We do Fog of War and all of that. So they've got the whiteboards.
Like, what do they do? Flat on the table, or is it up on the wall?
It's on the table, flat on the table.
Yeah, flat on the table.
Yeah,
cool.
And I've got like a big screen and another screen off to the side, and I just got a Falcon Northwest laptop to run everything. So you plug the TV and all the screens in, and you can put like the maps, player's map on one that you're manipulating, that they see, the DM's map on another one that you can manipulate, and then you can put all your monsters up in boxes on the big one in the middle, all your monster stats, and we just use tokens or figures for the monsters. We have our figures for our people. We play that way. It's a lot of fun. We've been having a good time. I wish they made map makers that didn't, like, we've learned how to cheat with the map maker we use to make it kind of easy, but the map makers, they make them for people who love making maps. I hate making maps. Give me something that I can draw on like it's a whiteboard, and I'm happy. And Roll20 can do that, so. But, yeah, so the little ones would come over, and they've got the whiteboards, right? So they put the whiteboards down on the floor, and they take all the monsters we're not using, and they make up their own games. I hit them for 37,500! It's fun, though. It's, like, just so much fun.
That's awesome.
You know, one thing I noticed reading the new book, and obviously you have you know, you have Dungeons and Dragons, you know, branding on it, and you're working with
I don't have any wizard to do that. The only thing I care about is the name of the book and my name on the cover. They can do everything else they want.
Okay, but it looks to me like in the text, it looks to me like there's quite a bit of energy into maintaining fidelity to like D&D rules and things that are newer rules than I grew up with myself. So you're careful about the interactions of vampire spawn, and I, you know what? I will never get used to the revised spelling of Spectre. I will confess. So yeah. How much thought process do you go into like making sure that this is aligned with current D&D rules?
I try to keep it as consistent as I can because, you know, I'm working in somebody else's playground here. And I actually like the 5e and 24 rules. There's some things I don't like about them, and I had to work around those. Like, I play the Bladesinger in a campaign before 24 came out. I play the Bladesinger. And what I noticed with the Bladesinger, I wanted to use the Shadow Blade, right? I mean, it's a great weapon. You're always in dim light. But, like, the concentration rules were like, come on. I'm now completely stovepiped. I can only do X, Y, and Z. You've taken 3/4 of my spells away from me unless I want to pooch myself, which I don't want to do. So I try to work around that as I can. And then, you know, I won't give anything away for the book, but I try to work around those things to make the character seem more real, to make it seem more plausible. But I've been doing that from the beginning. I've been doing that, you know, from the beginning.
Nice. I will say Paul and I rarely play 5th edition, but I always stumble over the concentration problems. So me no, you know, remembering classic D&D and expecting how spells work, I always wind up stumbling over the all the concentration limitations.
I'm not surprised Paul doesn't play 5e. The last game he ran for us wasn't even basic. It was like pre-basic. What was that?
It was original. Good old white box original D&D, I think.
White box original, yeah.
Yeah, that's
tough. Man, I might be partly to blame. I probably have a little bit of blame to have with that, frankly. So it's probably 80% Paul and 20% me, maybe, is what caused that.
I mean, I like other games, too. I cheat when I'm the DM, as in I want to make up stuff. I want to be agile. I want to react to what the players tell me they want to do and make a logical way for them to have a good chance of succeeding. So, like, 3.5 is a great D&D version, I think. But there's so many tables and rules that bogs down for me. I still love first edition D&D because it's faster. One thing that's driving me crazy about all the newer games, because of computer games, I mean, let's be real about it, is that, you know, a round of combat can take a half an hour.
Yes.
And, you know, if you're rolling, like, let's say you're playing a barbarian and you're raging, and you're using great weapon mastery, and you're using, I don't know, a two-handed sword, right? You're going to probably roll 4 sets of damage dice, and all 4 of them are different.
Yeah.
I get this bonus on my first attack because I'm this type of zealot or whatever it is. I get my rage bonus on this attack, but I don't get it on this attack. I can cleave because cleave is different, hex is different, or whatever it is. There's like, so that will take somebody, and you're rolling a lot of dice, right? So instead of first edition D&D, you roll your d20, I hit, roll a d8, 11. I get plus 6 here, plus 2 here, plus 1 here, plus 2 of my proficiency bonuses, blah, blah, blah. Roll. I hit.
Everybody loves to roll tons of dice, right?
Like, that's, everybody else is sitting around the table. What's the score of the football game? Right? That's one of the things why I like. Yeah. I mean, I'm having fun. I am having fun. We play with iPads around the table. I am having fun. We've managed this. I use poker chips. I love using poker chips because poker chips to me, like for keeping track of your spells by level, different colored poker chips, is a lot easier than finding it and clicking the box, making sure it clicked correctly on D&D Beyond. We still use D&D Beyond because it really helps when you need definitions and you need to check certain facts about it. But we've tried to streamline the game as much as we can because, you know, a 45-minute combat round is fun for only the person that's in the couple of minutes that it's their turn. Yeah.
Totally.
And like first edition, a combat round in first edition with six players took about a minute and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, agreed. I want exciting combats, but I want them to go super snappy and fast so that I can do lots of them. You know, have lots of action,
yep,
and lots of events happen in the game. That's always been my drive. But let me ask you this, because we had Luke Gygax on last week, and this came up for some reason. We were talking about using game or playing D&D or having our authors specifically playing D&D to feed into the game. Did you ever do that? Did you ever like, oh, I want to see how this battle might play out with like some real players?
I did in fourth edition, and I actually did it. I did it with a character named Oliver DeBurrows in my Crimson Shadow books. He's a highway halfling. And I was really going for a cross between Inigo Montoya from Princess Bride and the little French guy on the wall in Monty Python's Holy Grail. Kind of a cross between those two. So we're playing this dungeon, and Oliver is like, I will lead when there's no danger. And they come up on this building, and it's like the Parthenon, you know, it's got the pillars. And so the wizard casts a clairvoyance spell and looks through the pillars and says, there's nothing up there. And Oliver goes, well, I'll lead. And he goes running up the stairs, dancing around. And the wizard had missed the ogre that was pressed up against one of the pillars. And we play with that if you hit, at that time we were playing, if you hit, you roll percentage dice. And anything over 85 was triple damage. It was double up to that triple. And 100 is instant kill. And so this, now I'm first level thief with like 7 hit points. And this ogre comes out and hits me and criticals me. And so he's plus 18 to begin with, so I'm already dead under the old rules. And he's still got to roll 3d10 on top of that. Just his bonus of plus 6 puts me at negative 11, so I'm dead, right? Or negative 10, so I'm dead. So he squishes Oliver, and everybody around the table stood up and cheered, and that's when I knew Oliver had to be in the book. And for people who read that book, they love Oliver. I get tons of email about Oliver DeBurrows, the highway half.
That's great. That's great.
So, yeah. And when I wrote, I forget which book it was. I think it was Neverwinter. I actually did an anatomically correct fight with Efren and then Treri against some of the, I forget what they were fighting, but they were in Neverwinter Wood, and they were fighting some. And I did it by the fourth edition rules, exactly. What spells they could cast and how they would do, you know, because you have once a day feet, you got it.
Yep.
And oh my God, almost killed me. But I did it just to see if I could.
That's funny. I was just going to say, I always find,
no, this is fun. You guys just keep fighting each other.
We're gonna fight. I was just going to say, I always find your combat description very visceral, very cinematic, mm-hmm, which is really awesome. Like great to read. But I'm like, as I'm reading them, I'm like, I don't think he's rolling dice for each attack here.
No.
He's coming whole cloth out of Bob's head.
Have you seen? There's a video up of these two guys that did the Dritzen and Treri combat. Have you seen that video?
No.
Go to the Drow Historian. I just did an interview with him, so I went and looked at his videos. It's called The Drow Historian, plugging somebody else, sorry. But he's got a video about why they should make a Dritz TV show and how they should do it. And in there, he's got that embedded video of these two guys. They're sword fighters, theatrical sword fighters. And they do the Dritz and the Treri combat, and it's unbelievable. Actually, I think it's on my Facebook page, too, back a couple of months.
It is
unbelievable. It's exactly the way I picture it in my head when I'm writing the characters. Wow.
Fantastic.
So is that like when you're writing those combats, are you just like purely like visualizing in your brain what it looks like? Are you dramatically moving it around? Yeah. That's awesome.
Well, I mean, when I was in high school, I was boxing. We had a little boxing club in my buddy's cell, and we used to just go down and beat the crap out of each other. I was a bouncer. Paid my way through high school as a bouncer. I played hockey all my life. So the other thing is like I'm a big sports fan, but not in the way a lot of other people are. I like watching the beauty of motion. Like I could sit and watch Secretariat's Belmont run all day long, right?
Nice.
My favorite one is the Torval and Dean Bolero from the 1980 or 84 Olympics. That was when they first introduced ice dancing, and Jane Torval and Christopher Dean did the Bolero. And to me, that's like complete art. It's just art of motion. And so I watch things like that, and I watch, I pay really close attention. You know, I grew up watching Ali Frazier. And watching Muhammad Ali bounce around the ring was like, you can't move a body like that, but he does effortlessly with that shuffle. And it's almost like the rest of the world was in slow motion when he was on his game, right? He's moving his head. You can't hit him. 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 But he can hit you five times. And so I pay attention to that. I paid attention to it when I was boxing. I paid attention to it when I was bouncing. I paid attention, you know, when I had to get in a fight, when I had to stop someone from doing something bad. Visualizing the moves, not during it. You have to know beforehand what you're doing. So when I'm writing my battle scenes, I'm actually watching them fight. Where would they be when they finish this move? What do they have to do to get back to center? Because balance is everything. Anyone knows anything about sports or fighting knows that all your power comes from your hips and your legs, right? And the shoulder twist. You've got to have balance or you're doomed. I watch it. It's in my head. And I'm just clear writing. That was my major, tech writing. And I'm just putting it down. As I do it, taping it down.
Let me throw up a comment from one of our viewers, E. Wood, here, which I think is a good point and I agree with. E. Wood is saying, I noticed my favorite fantasy writers for battles tend to be big sports fans.
Oh, it makes sense. If you've never been in a fight, you don't know what it's like to be in a fight. If you've never watched, you know, ice skating, pairs competitions, ice dancing, if you've never watched horse racing, or Secretariat in particular, that's when you learn that horses are more than just this machine that runs. That was just one of the most instructional videos ever, was watching the Triple Crown when Secretariat ran it. If you watch boxing, if you watch football, if you watch basketball, which is probably one of the most graceful sports out there, you see how people move. You can't just make it up. You have to understand it. Yeah. You know, one of my biggest beefs is watching a sports movie where it's clear that the person directing the movie really know what the hell they were talking about. You know? It's like, because, you know, here's a dirty little secret about sports. You look at almost every Super Bowl, the other team could have won if one thing had been done. And a lot of times it's a lucky thing. It's not just a, you know, a lot of times it's a lucky thing, right? Even when it's my favorite team, I have to admit that. And that's true in sports. That's just the way sports are. A bad bounce, an untimely error, Bucky Dent. People that get that will understand the tone of my voice when I said that name. It's a Red Sox thing. I didn't use his middle name because I know it's a family show.
I think Steve.
You know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, I don't.
You guys can't write battle scenes. Forget it. In Boston, it's Bucky effing Dent. Bucky Dent was a little second baseman for the Yankees. And in the playoff game, this guy who couldn't hit a ball out of the infield hit a home run to win the game. And so for years, if you walk down the streets of Boston, you look at someone in the Red Sox jersey or hat, you'd look at each other and you'd both say, Bucky effing dead.
So, you know, I grew up in New England. I was watching, you know, Boston TV growing up and all the Boston teams, obviously. So growing up in Maine. And so I just got a nonstop diet of Celtics and Red Sox and Bruins and et cetera, et cetera. And I think I was about 40. You know, and my family's like five generations in Southern Maine. And I think I was in my 40s before I realized that my father is a long-term Yankees fan secretly. But I, wow. which he kept secret from the family, but it turns out he was Yankees fans all through his growing up. And I was like, wow, that's hard to digest, right? Yeah, right.
Yeah, my neighborhood, if somebody started dating a Yankees fan, they were forced to break up.
if he didn't keep it secret, maybe I wouldn't be here.
You wouldn't be. Or you wouldn't be you. Wow. You know, you shouldn't have announced that publicly.
I'm not giving his address out, so yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, don't do that. He'll get doxxed.
You're probably right. I don't know. I say a lot of stuff. People should.
I was at a Red Sox Yankees game. I was at a Red Sox Yankees game at Fenway, and the guy next to me had all his Yankees gear on. He's sitting down next to me. He's looking at him. I could just admit it. If there were no Red Sox, this game wouldn't be half as much fun. He goes, yeah, you're right. And we just had a blast. I bought him a beer. He bought me a hot dog or something, and we're just having a blast.
That's great.
Every time they get a hit, he'd look at me and say, bet that hurt. Just shut up. You know? So, yeah, I think, you know, another guy I think writes amazing battle scenes, Matt Stover. You know Matt Stover, Heroes Die. And Matt's a knife fighter. He's a knife fighter. I think you're seeing more of that now. I don't think you saw much of that before. In fact, I don't know how many people before me actually detailed battle scenes in books. That was something I insisted on doing.
It's, you know, you can tell
about that while reading this book. Actually, yeah,
you can tell when someone like understands physics and motion and is describing this stuff versus when they're just like faking it or phoning it. You keep mentioning Bob the figure skating, which is near to my heart, and this is probably a ridiculous reference to bring up, but there was in the early 90s there was a movie about a figure skater and a hockey skater who get together called The Cutting Edge. And it features an impossible move, right? The big move they do in the end is not possible by the laws of physics. And it oh my God, does it undercut things when you're watching it going like, wait, what? Wait, what happened?
Well, they have to get the story, right? I mean, I remember The Miracle on Ice. I'm old enough to have watched it.
Yeah.
And I remember it. And what they showed in the movie isn't the way that game played.
Yeah.
Because in the movie, you'd think that Jim Craig won the game all by himself, right? The goalie, right? Because they had to make it dramatic. They have to make it dramatic.
You could still do your research, though.
I don't think you do. You know,
nope.
To me, it's like, make it the way the game actually plays.
Yeah.
You're okay doing that.
Toe peek.
what a ridiculous movie! But just, oh my God, that end move, like, and they just had to like they couldn't show it, right? They had to like make weird cuts in the video because it's not possible. Anyway,
it's pretty far.
The move? That one's pretty far over.
He grabs her by her ankles, swings her around, throws her in the air, and catches her allegedly. Which is just like the trajectory of the release. Just no, she'd be across the rink, man. There's like that wouldn't work. You can't, unless she like rebounding off of the fans or something.
Do you know, aside from that, do you know that there's a move that one woman did in the Olympics of, like, I think a triple axel jump that is illegal? Like so a move that's so dangerous it's illegal.
Backflip
is that it? Right, there you go. And this one American skater was like had already like fallen or something, like knew she wasn't going to win, and therefore went and did the illegal move anyway, just as like a mic drop. If you can look that up on YouTube, and that is like terrifying move for her to do as a
What's amazing to me is the things that people can do with their bodies today compared to when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had Nadia Comaneci, but you watch Simone Biles sometimes. How can a human being do that?
Yep.
How can a human being do that? It is incredible. The body control, the brilliance of it. And it's the same with the NBA. I remember one time I was sitting with my brother-in-law, and he's a big Green Bay Packers fan from the 60s. He's older than I am. My oldest sister's husband. And we were watching a football game, and he says, "Ah, Pat, if you put the Green Bay Packers on the field with this team, they'd destroy them." And I said, "Tommy, the average weight of the Green Bay Packers offensive line was like 230 pounds. Everybody on that offensive line is over 300 pounds. That defensive linebacker that is 250 pounds of rock iron muscle runs a 4.440. No, you wouldn't have enough ambulances to take Green Bay away. It's just a different world now. I mean, watch the NBA now, and you watch Steph Curry draining shot after shot after shot off balance from 40 feet like it's nothing. Then you go back and you watch Bob Cousy, who was great for his day, right? He was the best. But you're watching him dribble with his left hand, and he's slapping the ball. It's not like today. It's very, very different. Very different.
There's a video that I enjoy so much with Bob Cousy in the movie. It's in a movie with maybe Nick Nolte, I think, where they're coaches. And so they do an improvisational scene where they're chatting about something, and Cousy is just throwing free throws, and Nolte is grabbing them and hand feeding them back to him. And Cousy is improvising dialogue while he's draining free throw after free throw after free throw after free throw.
Sure.
And at some point, Nolte calls him out in the scene and says, "Don't you ever miss?" And Cousy says, "Well, that's the goal of the game, is put the ball in the hole." And then he does it with the other hand.
Oh yeah.
And then drains that as well. And everybody breaks out of
Cousy the was way right. ahead of his time. But compare the moves that he would make, and his passing was exceptional. I mean, even today it would he could play in the NBA today. Kind of, but he'd be really tiny compared to these other athletes. But you watch the moves of some of the guys in the NBA today, and you go, "Wow, you know, how do you move your body like that?" Because the nutrition's better, the training's better. I mean, you know, baseball now they're measuring bat speed and exit velocity and all these other things in college. It is so far beyond what it was like pre-technology coming in and medical advances coming in. I mean, Bobby Orr Wayne Gretzky is established as the greatest hockey player of all time, and it's hard to argue. I mean, if you took every goal away from him, he's still the leading scorer of all time because just of his assists, right? Now, the guy is incredible. His geometry brain and making passes off the boards, incredible. But the most dominant hockey player I ever saw was Bobby Orr. Bobby Orr, I watched him kill a penalty all by himself. He just took the puck and rolled around in circles. He kept changing speeds, changing directions, made the other team look silly, killed the whole penalty all by himself. He's just the most dominant player I ever saw. If he had been playing today, his career would have gone 15 years longer. But his knees were shot after about six years.
Yeah.
You've got to take athletes, just like everything, you have to take it in the context of the times. That goes for everything from politics to athletes. You've got to take everything in the context of the times.
And that's the way you have to. You're right. There's a book by Stephen Gold. It's obviously a number of years old now, called Full House. I don't know if you read it. And it's half about baseball and it's half about evolution and the statistics of each. And he totally makes this point that as baseball players or whatever get better and better and more refined, they counterintuitively get closer and closer in skill. And then the results are going to be more based on a couple of moments of luck, like you were talking about there, Bob, in the Super Bowl games. And you'll never have, you know, these complete breakout seasons like you did in the distant past where people had crazy number of home runs or crazy high. They'll never. He makes a point that no one's ever going to beat Ted Williams' batting average, is that the pitchers and the hitters are too close in skill.
Right.
That you'll never yes. have this wide disparity again to break a record like that.
Yes, absolutely. You know, back in the 1970s, there was a guy named Nolan Ryan. And this guy was throwing 100 miles an hour in the ninth inning. Okay? It was insane. Now you have a whole bunch of guys that can hit 100 miles an hour. But they are specialized. They're usually relievers. Okay? They're specialized to that. And so to me, and this is true, I take this into my writing a lot too, because when I'm talking about the Forgotten Realms, for example, or my Demon Wars, one thing you have to keep in mind is that the sensibilities are different in different places, and you don't have like instant communication. So if Dritz goes to the jungles of Chult, he's not Dritz. He's just another drow that shows up in the jungles of Chult, right? Because they don't have television. They have unreliable narrator at best in the form of like wizards who teleport around. That's it. Who have their own agendas, right? So you have to keep all of those things in mind. You also have to keep in mind that people who have no experience with other people, other than their own clan, are going to bring with them different opinions than you expect of someone born in the 21st century or 20s, you know? You have to keep those things in mind when you're going back, even if you're just going back and judging people from like when they were 10 years old or 20 years old or 30 years old. What were the times like? I have freely admitted when I started writing these books, I was sexist. And I had 5 older sisters who I loved dearly, and every one of them is brilliant. But I was sexist. I thought women had roles, men had roles, period. And so did they. Okay?
Hmm. Yeah.
And I remember, you know, when Mary Kirchhoff read the first draft of The Crystal Shard, my first book, she said, "You have no named women that do anything in this book." I said, "Yeah, but it's a frontier town." She said, "What'd you just say?" Like, well, yeah. Now, Mary's my age, so she grew up the same way I did, but she saw the other side of it. I'm like, damn, you're right. And so that, you know, kind of opened my eyes, widened my horizons. And, you know, I mean, I just realized that the book I'm writing right now, the last book in Demon Wars, on the Buccaneer ship, 4 of the 5 most important people on this pirate ship are women with incredible skill sets. And I didn't do that on purpose. It just happened now. So I'm happy about that. I mean, that's growth, right?
Yeah.
But you always have to
grow in time.
That's why I get really like, somebody did an article on me once, and they're like, "Oh yeah, you know, his books are better now. He's gotten past the racism and the da 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 da. You know, he was writing about this and this and this." And my answer to him was, "Who the hell else was even writing about this stuff back then? Name them and shut up."
In terms of how it influences your writing, I kind of wanted to bring it back to, we were talking earlier about athleticism and how that changes generationally, right? Like the evolution and just the change of training technique, right? That the modern athletes are doing crazy things that athletes of the past were never able to do. Does that leak into your books at all? Are we going to see Breezy do crazy physical acts that we never would have seen Drist do?
Different. But no, that's not. She's getting the training from a young age, for example, in being a monk. And she finds a way of the monks that fits her. And Drist can't do that. But Breezy's
stylistically radically different.
The challenge for me was, here's someone who's being trained by the monks at the Monastery of the Yellow Rose in the ways of the monk, right? The open hand combat, the whole nine yards. She's being trained by her father, who's one of the greatest swordsmen around. She's being trained by her uncle Wolfgar in strength training and handling big weapons and fighting big things. She's being trained by the Harples in magic. She's being trained by her mother in magic, and her mother's a chosen of a god, of Maileiki. She's being trained by the dwarves in the way that they run their society. And all. She's got all of these things. How do you bring all of that together to get the best out of her? That's the challenge of the book. That's what the book's about. Her finding herself in the middle of all these other pieces that are being imposed on her from everybody around her.
Hmm.
And it was fun.
Nice.
And that's the biggest thing for me. It was fun.
For our older gamers that watch, I mean, it struck me that a major plot point is her goal, specifically in the monastery, of doing the trial by combat in order to rise from the level of, I think, superior master to master of dragons. Is that part of 5th edition rules?
No, I don't know. I doubt it.
Okay.
They are with all that stuff.
Because, I mean,
the Monastery of the Yellow Rose all that thing, Grandmaster Canon, all that, that's Doug Niles. He did that in the Throne of Bloodstone all the Bloodstone modules, which were amazing, right? Okay. And I used those characters in the Sellswords trilogy. I loved Kane. I kept going with Kane. He kept going. But when I wrote the Monastery of the Yellow Rose, I wrote it first edition. And I wrote that they follow the traditions of first edition D&D, period. You can be a superior master. But when you go beyond that, to become a master of dragons, there are three of them. You have to beat one.
Yep.
And then to go beyond that, it's master of the, I think it's the North Wind, or whatever. The next one, you have to beat that person, who then becomes one of the masters of dragons and has to fight his way back, or her way back up if they want to get there. So yeah, that is old school. It's within the order of St. Saulers, the Twice Mothered. Even though you don't have to be like a religious believer in the ways of the monk to be part of the monastery. Drist established that, but others have to. But I took that right from first edition.
It tickled me that there's this first edition thing in there that's a really strong through line in the whole book. I was pleased to see that.
Have you gotten past that point?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. So you see, there was more to it than that, wasn't there?
It's hard. It's a hard, right? It's trial by combat. It's tough. It's hard. Someone's not going to be happy, right?
Well, there may be other factors at play here.
It's first edition hardcore is what it is.
Yeah. Yep. I had fun doing that, designing the battlefield for them. To play to both their strengths, things like that. Yeah, no, I had a good time with them.
That was great.
I had a good time with them.
I remember reading those rules as a kid playing and being like intimidated by like, oh geez, I'm gonna have to come up with this whole thing for a player who plays this class. There, I'm gonna have to like have these one-on-one combats just so that they can level up. But in retrospect, I'm like, yeah, we never played that long. I never got people to that level. I don't know. Either of you ever
actually played? Oh, my God. By the time a month's doing it, everybody else is like 30th level, right? Because the way they stagger the experience?
Right.
I'm going to get Quivering Palm next level. You're going to get Quivering Palm next? Yeah, don't worry about it. You'll be 30th level by the time I get there.
Brilliant.
Okay, so I wind up asking this of all the authors that show up, and I've asked this of Ramsey Campbell and Michael Moorcock when we had him on. So are you committed? So when you write, are you only writing, are you only think about writing novel length stuff these days? Do you ever think about like short stories or different lengths of works?
I think about them more now, I think, than I used to. I had to do them before for Dragon Magazine and stuff. And every now and then I really loved doing them, like Bones and Stones was one I did that I really loved. Now I've done a couple of novellas for Audible. I did one about Jarl Axel, One-Eyed Jax, and I did one about Breezy in Betwixt Two Worlds. And I loved it. I may do a couple more of those. Maybe. I don't know.
Great.
I'm really not committing to anything.
I'm going to throw up a question from a viewer right at the start of the show here today. Ada Lenny asked specifically about Betwixt Two Worlds. Will there be a textbook version? And they have a bit of a language issue that they're dealing with. Will there be a textbook version of that?
When I wrote those for Audible, and I had to do some short story or chapter ads for Barnes & Noble editions of the books, because you have to, like, everything's different now as they try to make sure they get the right buys from this place, the right buys. It's such a different world. Publishing is a mishmash. But one of the things I insisted upon was the ability to take those after a certain amount of time and put them in print, if I got a publisher to do it. So yeah, I could imagine filling out the two I did, doing a third, maybe a fourth, or taking some of the Barnes & Noble editions and putting them in there and doing an anthology on those. The problem with that, of course, is anthologies just don't sell as well as novels. They just don't. That's just a reality of the world. Right now, I'm just thrilled because Del Rey is taking all of the Dritz books, the first 33 anyway, the other six Harper has, and they've already done it. And they're putting them out in new covers, trade paperback, and I think the plan is to go and do omnibus editions eventually of in hardcover of all the trilogies or quartets through it. So that's, you know, I'm thrilled about that. The other thing I'm thrilled about is we just did the first Demon Wars book, just did a Kickstarter on this $100 big, gorgeous Demon Awakens book. And those are, they finally got them. They had some issues with printing without everything going on with China and stuff, but they've got them and they're shipping now. I just got mine in and they're fantastic. So I'm really excited to see those kind of rebirths of the older books and things. Open Road Media is now doing the Crimson Shadow books and the Spearwielder's Tales. The Demon War books, the seven original Demon War books, are now all out in these beautiful trade paperbacks from Saga. And they're the ones I'm doing the new books for, the Buccaneers series. So I'm really happy that a lot of the older stuff is still floating around. Because, you know, the thing is, the original... the early Dritz books still sell like crazy. They still, and especially in audio, it's like incredible how many they're still selling.
Nice.
That makes me happy. My book signings look like Fleetwood Mac concerts, right? You got a grandfather with his son and his granddaughter, and they're all reading the book. I love that.
That's the best.
Fantastic.
That's the best. I think you have a signing at New York Comic Con in a couple of weeks, right? I think October 11th, 12th, you're at New York Comic Con doing signings.
The book comes out the 7th, and I'm doing a signing at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, New Hampshire. If you can't make it, you can order it online from them, and I'll sign it for you there, and they'll ship it out. There's also e-signings running at my wife's online store, rasalvastore.com, where you can pre-order the book, get it signed and personalized, and at rasalvatore.com, although I think that one's about to close because he's got to get the books and drive up from Pennsylvania with the books. He's got a ton of them this time. This book did really well with that. And then I'm going to New York Comic Con on the 9th, Thursday the 9th, but I won't be in until the 10th, and I have two signings on the 10th and two signings on the 11th, Saturday, Friday and Saturday. And then I'm arriving back home Saturday night. So yeah, I'm coming out of my shell. I don't do this much anymore.
Fuck that.
Yeah.
Well, we're happy to have you. I got one last question for me. How many books have you written? Because at the start of this, there's a I was kind of like staggered by the list of like other works by Mr. Salvatore here, and it just goes on and on.
All right. Well, let me preface that by saying it's easier to write a book in a series than it is to write something completely different. So I could write a Dritz book in 4 months. I could write a new book in like 7, maybe. Right?
Wow.
Because once you're just telling the story, you know who the characters are and they're all established. You have to tell the story a little differently than you would if you were just coming in cold. There are 39 core Dritz books. That includes the Cell Swords. There are the 5 Cleric books. So that's 44. There are the 3 Stone of Tomorrow books that I wrote with Gino. That's 47. 2 Star Wars books is 49. Tarzan book is 50. There are 7, 11, 14, 16 Demon War books with one more coming. So that's 66. There's 3 in the Echoes of the Fourth Magic series. So that's 69. There are 3 in the Crimson Shadow series. So that's 72. And there are 3 in the Woods Out Back series. So that looks like 75 to me. Not counting like the Dial of Dritz, the anthologies, things like that. Just novels.
I mean, yeah, of course.
Yeah. So 75.
Amazing. I mean, hey, look,
it's like you got to understand something. I'm not writing 500,000 word doorstops. It's not my style. It's not what I read. It's not what I write. I'm writing 110,000 word stories, and I take my job seriously. I take this career seriously. My kids were little. They'd be playing hockey. I'd go to their games, and we're watching the game, and then the Zamboni comes out between periods, and I'm typing up in the stands. I couldn't shut it off. I couldn't shut it off. I came from a working-class background. My wife came from a single mom. Her dad died in the military. Single mom, didn't even speak English when she came here from Germany. Working class background, we didn't have anything. When we got married, we had nothing. And I'd go to work, I'd come home, I'd flip her the keys to the one car, and then she'd go to work. And I'd take care of the kids. That was our life. And once I quit my job in 1990, when the Halfling's Gem hit the New York Times list, and Wizard said, okay, TSR said, we want 3 more books. Maybe it's time to quit your job. So I did. I quit my job. I was terrified. And I didn't stop writing. I wrote The Legacy in 6 weeks. The opportunities presented, and I jumped at it. I took it seriously. I still take it seriously. Just the difference now is I'm finally finding me away from it now. I'm saying, I don't need to be doing X, Y, and Z. I don't need to be upstairs on a deadline typing when everyone's in the pool. Or when they want to go to King Richard's Fair with the kids, or they're going apple picking or something, I go.
Yeah. See? No more typing during Zamboni breaks?
Oh, hell no. 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 I don't need to. I did then. I mean, we had nothing. My wife and I were fighting just to get through every day. It wasn't easy. No, I found a better work-life balance, and like I said, I'm 66 years old. I'm trying to stay healthy. I'm working out all the time. I'm still playing softball. I'm trying to fight every day to the grave, right? I'm fighting it. But I want my life. And but I don't want to quit writing. This is the thing. Everything, oh, he's not going to write anymore. That's not true. There are times when all of a sudden something will come to me like Breezy in this book. And I have to sit down and write it. It's a compulsion. I will wake up in the middle of the night and I'll be thinking about it. I'll get up in the morning later and I'm still thinking about it. I'll go to bed at night and I'm thinking about it. I can't get it out of my head until I get it out of my head, because it's a question I need to ask myself, that I'm doing so through the character. It's like my spiritual journey is exploring myself through my works. I'm not going to stop doing that. I'm just not going to be fanatical about it anymore.
Well, here's love hoping it. You still manage to figure out a way to make it to 100. Fuck.
Years or books?
Both. Both. Those are good books.
Both. Both, I say.
Wait. If it's one or the other, I'm going with years, buddy.
Going years. Yeah, good choice. Speaking of which, we are about out of time here on the show. Bob, was there anything else you wanted to get out about the book or your upcoming schedule? Anything else you want our fans to know before we take off?
You can still go to Ari Salvas. I gotta plug my wife's store. She just walked in and saw me on. If I don't plug her store, she'll punch me. I don't blame her. Ari Salvas store, bestdadjokeever.com. You can get all of the. And we have a whole bunch of books. You can get any of them signed, personalized, birthday presents, Christmas presents, whatever. We'll be putting up the new Demon Awakens book because we got some extras. The $100 really special edition book for Christmas. We're putting that up. We'll be putting up some Christmas specials soon, but we are pre-ordering. We're ordering tomorrow, I think. But we're going to keep ordering The Finest Edge of Twilight. So if you want to get a first edition, well, I can't promise that anymore. That's the other thing about this business now. I can't promise first edition anymore because they don't go to press the way they used to. They used to go to press with a big printing, take some back, and then if it was still hot, they'd do a second printing. Now they go to press with this much, and then they print it again. And then they print it again. So it's first edition, but it's second, third, fifth, eighth printing. It's very different than it used to be. But we get the books right from Ingram Warehouse. I sign them. I personalize them, you know. To Paul, you suck as a DM. Love, Bob. You know. we miss Paul. Paul is great. We miss Paul. Had to say that. Sorry. So, yeah, let me plug the store. If you want books signed, that's the way to do it.
Okay. Great. We'll include a link to that in the show notes here.
Awesome.
Definitely.
Viewers, right. If you have any further, if you're not sure where to go, obviously, like I said, we'll put that link right there in the description of the YouTube video here. If you have questions for that we somehow missed that you were just dying to get out to Bob, drop us a comment here in the YouTube video. I'm sure we will get him back someday in the future. And we'd love to hear from you.
We'll look forward to that. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, GitHub. I think we just added Instagram in the last week, Instagram. Actually. So look for us on Instagram now. We do have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and tear into that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only format, you can find those podcasts on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also through various podcast carriers like iTunes, Spotify, Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation about gaming and novels and books and writing and miniatures continues around the clock 24/7. We just have the best patrons there. And like Paul said at the top of the hour, we will be there in about 10 minutes to continue with our live after show chat, where we video chat with our patrons if they have questions to us in particular. So we'll look forward to that. And of course, enormous thanks today to Mr. R.A. Salvatore. Thanks for joining us today.
That was my pleasure. You guys are great.
We'd love it. And of course, we're live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please, we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.